entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
It sure is. Welcome in to a Sunday morning, the best of Downtown. It's December, Kerry Haskell. How in the world did that happen?
It's felt like December for about a month already.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah, bring it on.
We're ready for it. Absolutely. Hope your Thanksgiving went well. The long weekend continues. Any leftovers remaining in the Haskell household?
Oh, there would still be some. The turkey was like a 24-pounder.
Oh, so. My.
Yeah, we're probably on turkey pot pie by now.
I am, I'm done. I'm done with turkey officially. It's a 3-4 days of it. Good. See you again next year, old bird. Appreciate it. Coming up this weekend, today, here on the program, our look at a couple of recent conversations of note. Two terrific ones, actress Cindy Williams and, jack of all trades, singer, producer, musician, manager, and now author Peter Asher will chat with us about his new book on the Beatles. But first, Cindy Williams, you know her, of course, as Shirley Feeney in Laverne and Shirley, but much more than that in her career, from fairly recent appearances on Broadway in The Drowsy Chaperone to films like American Graffiti and The Conversation, and friendships that you might not expect with folks like Ed Begley Jr. and Andy Kaufman. Fascinating conversation with the absolutely delightful Cindy Williams. Cindy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So much to talk about with you, but let's go back to the beginning and talk about how you found a home for yourself when you were in high school in a play production class that had some pretty talented people as well as yourself.
Oh, yes, well, that was sort of my first experience with theater, and I had tried out for the talent show, and instead the director of the theater arts department asked me, he said, well, you made it into the talent show, but I think you should think about taking theater arts as an elective. I'll put you straight into play production. And so I said, what the hey? And I did. I was thrilled. And I was in the class with Sally Field, and who was marvelous, but she was in and out of class because she was doing, I believe, The Flying Nun, which I was very jealous of, but even more so when she got the role of Gidget. And then I was green with envy.
After school, you went...
Even then, Rich, she was a marvelous, marvelous actress. At 15, she was brilliant. And it didn't take a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. She was brilliant on stage.
You made the decision to study theater in college as well, but it sounds like a really wonderful break and opportunity for you, and something that you remain proud of was that acceptance into the Actors Studio.
Well, that came after I went to Los Angeles City College and enrolled in the theater arts department there. And that was just by happenstance with my good friend, Vern Joyce, who I'd met in the theater arts department at Los Angeles City College. And he had gone to New York and auditioned for the Actors Studio and made it to the final round. But when he made it to the final round, he had moved back to Los Angeles. So he asked me if I would do his final audition scene with him. And I said, sure. So the pressure's off of me, you see. So anyway, so I did the scene with him, and lo and behold, he made it in, and they made me a member also. And it was due mostly to his fine talent and, taking me along with him and just being brilliant in that scene. So, yes, I am a member of the acclaimed Actors Studio.
Now, while you were in L.A., you also got a job because you need something to make the ends meet, pay the bills, and you worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go and had a memorable run in, a lot of famous people, but I especially love the story in your book about Jim Morrison.
You know, Rich, it's very tough to tell this story because I'd have to be, there in front of you and the listening audience to act it out. But, yes, I got a job as a cocktail waitress at the Whiskey at Go-Go during the height of, you know, the, just the height of the 60s and everything that was going on the Sunset Strip there and in L.A. and around the world, actually. And so my first night, they gave me the VIP section to wait, which I was surprised about because only the older, more, you know, schooled, the scholared cocktail waitresses got to serve the VIP section. But they gave it to me, and they said, you know, and the girl said, that's your first table over there. And I walked over, and there was a gentleman who was sitting with his back to me, and there were two blonde girls. I remember they were blonde. Both blonde because they both ordered Tom Collins. Both ordered the same drink and both had the same color hair. Anyway, and then I asked the gentleman, I said, and for you, sir, and he turned around and it was Jim Morrison in this light that was like a godly light from heaven upon him. And he looked like a Greek god and I was stammering and he said, I'll have a bottle of Jack. And I wrote down bottle of Jack. I took it over to the bartender, Tony, and I put it up. And he said, what's this bottle of Jack? Is Morrison in the club? And I said, yes, Jim Morrison is in the club. And he said, well, he knows perfectly well I can't serve him a bottle at the table. Tell him a single or a double or that's it. So I had the task of going back to tell Jim Morrison he couldn't have a bottle of Jack on the table. And he said, who's tending bar? Is it Tony? And I said, yes. And he said, he served me a bottle of Jack before. He'll serve me a bottle of Jack tonight. Go tell him that. And so I had to go back to Tony. And then he sent me back again. Then they started calling each other names. And I was supposed to carry these messages back and forth until I was in tears. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Morrison, but I cannot serve you a bottle of Jack. I can bring you a double or a single. I'll buy it for you. And he took my hand and he said, what's your name? And I said, Cindy. And he said, well, Miss Cindy, we're just playing with you. And I turned around and everyone was laughing at me. All the waitresses, the busboys, Tony, all the bartenders, everyone. And he pranked me. And he said, I'll take a double. And that was it. And then that was it. They sent me up to the peanut gallery. They sent me to a different section. They had only sent me to the VIP section to do that to me, you know, and so it was fun. I mean, in the end, it's a great story to tell, but it's a tough story to tell because, as I said, if I was there in front of you, Rich, I'd act it out and it'd be much more colorful.
I'm picturing you acting it out, if that helps.
Okay, it does help. It does help picture me running back and forth. And being just terribly upset because I couldn't bring a bottle of Jack Daniels to Jim Morrison's table.
You also made friends very early on with Ed Begley Jr., who wrote the foreword to your book and is right up front about the fact that he always hoped it would be more than friends, but in the long run, it's worked out very well for both of you.
Oh, he's like my little brother in a way. You know, I mean, his daughter Amanda is my goddaughter, and I'm just, you know, he's like family, and just a wonderful, wonderful actor, wonderful, you know, I mean, just an environmentalist. That's where I basically learned, you know, all of that from. I mean, he used to drive. I saw him coming off a freeway off-ramp one time in an electric golf cart. And he had a friend with him, and he picked me up for a date one time. This is when I first met him in that golf cart, and he just practices what he preaches, and he's got a beautiful home that's off the grid. You know, everything is off the grid. He also came to a party I was giving one night and asked if he could plug his car into my socket in the garage, and I said sure. And he blew all the lights out at the party, everything, that darn electric car. But he was way, way ahead of the curve, way ahead of the curve. And he's a darling friend of mine, just a fabulous person.
We're talking with Cindy Williams here on Downtown. Well, an early break came when you were cast in the television series Room 222. I love that show. I'm a teacher in my full-time job, and one of the reasons is I was so inspired by that show as a kid. What a great opportunity that was for you as well.
It was my first job, and if memory serves me, it was James Brooks who hired me for that job, and I play that character, Rhoda Zagor. I'll never forget her name, Rhoda Zagor. And I played that character three times, but the first time was on an episode that I believe won an Emmy. I think it was called The Substitute Teacher. I'm not sure, but because I only remember me, of course. And it was my very first job, and so they also played a prank on me on that show. But it was a a historic show because it had, the principal and one of the teachers were black actors. And it was one of the first shows that ever had, actors who are African-American as the lead.
Right, Lloyd Haynes.
But you know what? It didn't matter. I mean, you just saw no, you didn't go on the show and say, gee, there's black actors here. It was like just this show that was just wonderful, and every actor on the show was sublime. And but it was that show that had, two of the first African-American actors be leads.
Lloyd Haynes and Denise Nicholas.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you, Rich.
That's why I'm here. It's what I do.
They were fantastic people to work with, just so encouraging and lovely and just wonderful actors.
You got the role in a film being made by George Lucas, the role of Laurie Henderson in American Graffiti, and I was surprised to learn that was not the role you wanted.
No, I wanted Candy Clark's role of Debbie, bad girl, the risque girl. And then that was already cast when I was offered the part of Laurie. So then I said, well, what about Carol? And the casting director, who was Fred Roos, said, well, Carol is a 12-year-old. And I said, I'll put braces on, and I could do it. And he goes, well, believe it or not, Cindy, I've actually cast a 12-year-old to play a 12-year-old. So anyway, all's well that ends well, because it was a fantastic film and just an incredible experience. And I played the girl who cries the entire night.
I love that movie so much. But you also made another movie not long after that for some reason people don't talk about as much. I think it's one of the great movies of the 70s, and that's The Conversation. That was such an incredible film.
Yes. Francis Ford Coppola wrote it and directed it, of course, and that was monumental for me. And it was a brilliant, brilliant script, brilliant movie, and I was so fortunate to be in it. And they referred to it as that little movie Francis did in between Godfather.
Right.
And he did. He did it in between Godfather 1 and 2, and that was a movie that he made. And it was just fantastic. I was so blessed to be in that film.
Talking with Cindy Williams here on The Best of Downtown, and we'll get back to it more with Cindy after this break at Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's three times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Fall never tasted so good. Right now, the Ground Round has a special fall menu. So for a limited time, come in and try these truly delectable dishes, like the Nashville Hot Boneless Wings, the Mini Heroes, and the Three Pigs in a Bun Sandwich. It's pork belly, pulled pork, and a fried pork cutlet with provolone and coleslaw packed in a split-top bun and served with your choice of a side. Like I said, fall never tasted so good. So get to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor today, online at groundround.com.
ClearPoint Capital is excited to be the official financial advisor sponsor of the Maine Black Bears. At ClearPoint Capital, our client relationships are built upon trust, proactive service, state-of-the-art planning tools, and a disciplined investment process. ClearPoint Capital is your financial advocate. Your success is our success. See what our team can do for you and your family. ClearPoint Capital and the Maine Black Bears. Now that's a winning combination.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. Call us today at 307-7718.
Fall's here, so winter can't be far away. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street in Bangor, wants you to be ready for winter. Bring your vehicle in right now and have it winterized. They'll check the battery, antifreeze, tires, shocks, and a whole lot more. Don't wait. Be ready when the bad weather gets here. Make an appointment today. Call Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, or check them out on the web at bangortire.com. Bangor Tire Company, 35 Market Street, Bangor. More than just a tire store.
Give yourself the gift that keeps on giving, the gift of saving money with Fujitsu heat pumps from Valley Home Services. Now through December 31st, get instant discounts of $400 for single-zone systems and $800 for multi-zone. Combined with Efficiency Main rebates, and you save a minimum of $900. With Efficiency Main financing, you can save up to 50% on energy bills for as little as $30 a month. Celebrate the season of giving with savings from Fujitsu heat pumps and Valley Home Services. Home is our middle name.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hasenbeck, and Corporate. Ah, there you go.
Cindy Greco, her only hits, surprisingly. The theme from Laverne and Shirley, which starred new friend of downtown, Cindy Williams, part two of our conversation with her here on The Best of Downtown. You had earlier signed up to work with Fred Roos and Gary Marshall as reps for you. And we've talked to so many people from Henry Winkler to Don Most to Anson Williams and all of them, Michael McKean, all have talked about what an incredible influence Gary Marshall was, not just on their career, but his people, that it was like going to school being around him.
Well, he was methodical in always wanting to be cohesive with a family. And I don't want to say morality, but it was like a family. It was like the golden rule. He always wanted that to be present. I mean, he didn't put it like that, but there always had to be a thought process of why the characters came to the at the end of the piece, if they tried to do something. For instance, Penny and I, Laverne and Shirley, get a rebate on their gas bill, and they find out that it's a mistake. So they question, should they spend the money or shouldn't they spend the money? And so that's Gary's doing that. At the end, we talk to each other about how right it was of us to give the money back, and that had we spent the money and kept it for, you know, for ourselves, you know, that wouldn't have been right. But we did it in comedic terms, you know, on a comedy level. And he was a genius at that. And that was always something he wanted questioned. Like, I don't wear fur. And on this show we did where we were diving for dollars, I forget what it was called, but we get on this game show, and we almost win a fur coat and a trip to, you know, a cruise and all this money. And in the end, we finally lose. And I had said to Gary, I just don't want to have to put that fur coat on. I don't want to put it on because I'm so against wearing fur. And he said, all right, I'll write you a line. So he wrote me a line where at the end we're discussing how we were kind of greedy, wanting to win that show, and we'd do anything to win it, and how it might have been best that we didn't win. And I said, I was willing to wear the fur of an animal. I forget. It was a funny line, but I said, and that, you know, I was so greedy, I was willing to wear the fur of an innocent animal. And Gary wrote that for me. And so he always had an eye on what good and bad, you know, and that goodness in a person should always trump the bad in that person. And that's how he, and if you watch Happy Days or any of his television shows, it's always good versus, I mean, it's always good wins out. And he always kept an eye on that, along with being just a phenomenal comedy writer.
I was surprised to learn.
Always kept an eye on that.
I was surprised to learn, Cindy, they were reluctant to let you get involved in a lot of the physical comedy in the first season of the show.
Well, this goes back to playing Laurie, you know, to every even when I was on Room 222, I played the character that, you know, the lead's best friend. He said, what's the matter, Jeannie? He didn't mean to leave you. You know, I'm sure he still likes you. And then in American Graffiti, crying, you know, all the time. And so they never saw me as a comedian, I don't think. And so the first two seasons, maybe, yeah, of the show, I had to fight for that. Really fight for it. And they knew Penny could do it because they'd been on Odd Couple with her and because she's Gary's sister. But I kept going to Gary and saying, give me a chance. I can do physical comedy too. I'm very agile. Look. Anyway, he finally one day he came to me and he said, we're going to write you something and it's going to be physical and we'll see how you do. And then, you know, take it from there. So they wrote me this thing where we're doing our house cleaning, and Penny gets the vacuum cleaner stuck on her lip because she's taking it off, and she's just got the tube there, and she gets it stuck on her lip, and all it said in the script was Shirley pulls it off. Shirley helps her get it off her, you know, her mouth. And so I just came up with all the physical things to do there. And I think I ended up putting my foot on her chest and pulling. I'm not sure. But after that, Gary said, okay, you proved it to us. You know, we'll start writing you physical comedy along with Penny to do. And that's sort of how it became a two-person physical show.
I think people might be surprised to learn that you were great friends as well with the late Andy Kaufman.
Oh, yes, Andy. Yes, yes. What can I say? It's all there. You know, I had seen him on Saturday Night Live and just thought he was brilliant. I couldn't take my eyes off of him. And he was playing the congas and doing that funny thing where he cries while he's singing, kind of. And I remember I was in a room of all my, I was in an acting class, and we were having an after-class party, and Saturday Night Live was on. And I said, look at this guy. Everybody, come here and look. And I remember them all gathering around and all watched Andy. And then I met him at the Improv one night, and he asked me if I could give him a ride home, and I said, sure. And then he started, we became friends, and then he started asking me if I'd like go to, if I was in New York, I'd go to Caroline's in the, you know, go to Caroline's and do a midnight show with him. And it's all in the book where he doesn't tell me what he's going to do. He just tells me what he wants me to do on stage. And then I realize as I'm standing there that he's doing something that could possibly have the audience turn on us both. It was an honor, to get to work with him. And I also did his special that he had on ABC. And I just got him. Like most people that get him, it's a real different take on things. But it does make you happy. He just made people happy, and it snuck up on you. And I just loved, he was so marvelous. And so, and one time he came over to my house, and that character that he did, that obnoxious character.
Clifton, Tony Clifton.
Tony Clifton. And he refused. He was dressed like him. And I'd never seen Tony Clifton before. And he came to the door, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he had this funny mustache on, and he was, you know, ordering me around and telling me to put the... I had a cat at the time, and telling me that cat's staring at him. Put that cat in the other room. I said, "Andy, what are you doing?" And he kept saying, "Refer to me as Tony. I'm Tony." It got me so upset that I finally ended up pulling his hair and saying, you better be Andy. Anyway, that's in the book. That's tough. I'd have to be in front of you again and show you what I meant by what went on there. But I finally got him out of that character. But it went on for hours before I, you know, got him. He said, "What do you want? What do you want?" I grabbed his hair at the temple because somebody told me if someone ever accosts you, grab his hair, grab their hair at the temple when full. So I did, and he said, okay, what do you want? And I said, "Be Elvis." And he pops up and he goes, "Well, hello, little lady," like that. And he was Elvis. Anyway, it was a most marvelous, most marvelous adventures I had with Andy Kaufman.
Wonderful,
and a sweetheart of a person, and just an incredible entertainer, comic, you know, comedian.
You returned to the stage and have traveled all around the country doing shows, but how big a thrill was it to make your Broadway debut in The Drowsy Chaperone?
Oh, my goodness, that was a dream come true. That was... you know, everything that if you study theater and you you're on stage in college and then you take classes, the whole aim is to make it to Broadway or the London stage, but Broadway. And then I did. And of course, with my luck, I obviously was on strike, and so I couldn't rehearse. And and they closed the show 3 weeks after I started doing the show, because the IOSI strike had, you know, really maimed the show as far as business was concerned. But I got to be, I call it my 3 weeks on Broadway, and I don't write about that in the book because I hadn't done it yet.
Right. Cindy, it's such a treat to talk with you. We've enjoyed your work for so many years. We thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me on, Rich. It's been my pleasure, believe me.
Cindy Williams on The Best of Downtown. Did you have any idea, Carrie, that she was close friends, very good friends with Andy Kaufman?
Not at all. I'd seen the special that she was a part of, but I assumed it was just one of those Kaufman things where let's bring in sort of the oddest star I can compared to me and have her in the show. But it turns out that wasn't the case. They'd been doing stand-up bits at Caroline's in New York for a while.
Yeah.
Was just amazing.
Yeah, and Kaufman would go to her house because her mom loved to hear Andy Kaufman do Elvis. And there's a great story in the book, too, about Kaufman running into Elvis in an elevator and doing it for him. And he loved it, too. So very cool stuff there with Cindy Williams. Her book now out in paperback is called Shirley, I Jest. When we come back, music legend Peter Asher writes about the Beatles in a brand new book, The Beatles from A to Z. We'll talk about it right after this on The Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Central Street Farmhouse, downtown Bangor, for the best home brewing ingredients, equipment, and advice that you'll find anywhere. Plus, make your own wine right in the store. How does that work? Pick a wine kit, make an appointment, and whip up 6 gallons of the best wine you'll ever taste in less than 30 minutes. 2 months later, come back to bottle it and take it home. They offer these wine classes every day they're open, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Call 992-4454 or see them on Facebook to find out more.
Come in to enjoy a nice lunch at the Sea Dog Brewing Company in Bangor. Happy hour after a long day at work or for a delicious dinner with family or friends. Looking for some fun during the week? Well, the Sea Dog has the best theme nights around. Come in for Monday night socials with Riff Johnson. Tuesdays are our $2 taco and $5 margarita night. Wednesday is our cornhole tournament with Sea Dog gift cards for prizes. Thursday night at 6, the Sea Dog becomes the home of the Maine Black Bears with the UMO Football Coaches Show. On Friday and Saturday nights, we have your favorite live bands playing for your enjoyment. And let's not forget, it's football season, and the Sea Dog will always have the best games on. Make sure you like Sea Dog Brewing Company Bangor on Facebook for all of our upcoming events, and we'll see you at the Sea Dog, Front Street, Bangor, or on the web at seadogbrewing.com.
Penobscot Theater Company presents...
I love books. Last week, I read quite a few.
An exhilarating tale of empowerment.
I wonder if I'm not just a bit different from my friends.
A brave little girl in a big bad world.
That's not right.
This holiday, Roald Dahl's Matilda the Musical. December 5th through the 29th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
Even if you're little, you can do a lot.
What makes a community thrive? The people who live in it. When you use your First National Bank Visa debit card at participating local businesses, you save on everyday purchases while supporting the people who work day in and day out to make your town a vibrant, unique community. Receive cash back on purchases and support the local businesses that make our communities thrive. Bank local, buy local. Learn more at dreamfirstrewards.com. First National Bank. Dream first, because you can. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor. Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning, first day of December. Our next guest knows the Beatles awfully well, a longtime friendship, well, really with all of the Beatles, but especially Paul McCartney, who lived in their house in the mid-60s when he was dating Peter Asher's sister, Jane. Peter's come a long way from his days working with Gordon Waller as Peter and Gordon to producing people like Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, being a successful manager, hosting a Sirius XM radio show on the Beatles channel called From Me to You, and a brand new book, The Beatles from A to Z. And we had a great time talking Beatles and more with Peter Asher. Peter, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
Love the book so much. I love the organization of it. But as you explain, you thought it perhaps might be an easy transition to take some of these stories from the SiriusXM show and turn them into a book. But it sounds like apparently this writing is pretty hard work.
Well, exactly. I mean, you'd think that, you know, because this wasn't my idea, by the way. It was, you know, the radio show I was doing anyway, and I had the idea of doing those 26 episodes of it as the Beatles from A to Z, using the alphabet to supply not only, you know, song titles, but people and places and musical instruments and ideas and all kinds of stuff. Basically, an idea I stole from Sesame Street. So, but then a publisher came and said, we think that, you know, that A to Z would make a great book. And I was thinking, oh, that sounds pretty easy. You know, just transcribe whatever I said on the radio and it'll be a book. And of course, what happens is you do that, you transcribe it and you start reading it and you go, this is just awful as a book. You know, it doesn't work because, you know, the way you talk to people when you're talking to them on the radio isn't the same as what you want to read in a book. And of course, on the radio, you can go ahead and play the record. In the book, you have to explain why the record's so special and so good and what was remarkable about the Beatles. So anyway, it turned out to be much more of a task than I realized. But it was kind of fun and actually made me look at some of the tunes and some of the ideas and things that I'd always taken for granted and try and figure out how to, you know, add to people's, if I could, add to their appreciation and understanding of the Beatles and what they stood for and what they accomplished and their great songs.
Well, wonderful stories, and expands beyond the sphere of just the Beatles to talk about other artists, adventures on the road, and a wonderful global perspective on music. And some of them, yeah, I did what you suggest in the book. I went immediately online and started listening to some music, some that I knew very well, some I thought I knew. And I just want to throw a few of them out there from the book. I was so happy to see that you enjoy as much as I do, Eddie Izzard's interpretation of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Yes, it's excellent. It's bizarre and it's wonderful, and I'm a big Eddie Izzard fan. He's totally brilliant.
I also love the story that you tell about Russ Kunkel. Can you explain how Russ Kunkel was inspired by Ringo's drum fills on With a Little Help from My Friends when you were in the process of recording James Taylor, especially Fire and Rain?
Yes. Well, when I came out to L.A. to make James's first American album, you know, I was looking to put a little band together, and I found Russ Kunkel. He'd never done a session before as a studio musician, but he was actually playing with a guy called John Stewart, a wonderful songwriter, not the John Stewart on television, but a terrific guy. And I heard his drumming and loved it because he was doing, in the general sense, a bit what Ringo does, which is just play exactly what the song needs and no more, you know. So whereas some drummers frantically try to fill it, get in a lot of flashy stuff, you know, which has its place and is great to hear and see. But Ringo kind of arranges a drum part for the song, and Russ does that too. And when it came to Fire and Rain, there's no question but the fills, you know, those big boom, 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 boom sort of fills that Russ played with brushes, which is interesting too. When we recorded that song, they certainly owe something to the fills in Day in the Life and some other Beatles songs where they've got those beautiful, big, fat, solid Ringo fills that are just designed precisely for the space they fill.
Well, and another one of those is one of my very favorite Beatles songs of all time, and that's Rain. What is it about that song that you love so much?
Well, it's interesting because it's very different. I mean, in terms of the drum part specifically, since we were talking about Ringo, you know, I was talking to Ringo. I told him I was writing about drum fills, and he asked me what some of my favorites were. And when I mentioned Rain, he explained that he's playing very differently on that than anything else he's ever played. He just started playing the drums kind of in a different order, and they in a way, they're a little un-Ringo-ish, but they're brilliant. I mean, they're quite extraordinary, the drumming on Rain. And there's those places where he and Paul McCartney worked out those fills precisely together. You know, there's that place where the bass plays a melodic line as the drums play the fill. You probably know the place. I mean, I'm not trying to sing it, but it's one of those pauses where everything stops for a minute, and the drums and the bass have a little sort of moment of their own, and then bring everybody back in. And I love that record anyway. There's so much about it that's unusual and original. And that can be said of so many Beatles songs. You know, that's what's so interesting. I talk about time signatures and how you know, often they used without even particularly thinking about it. They would have bars of 5/4 and 7/4 and stuff mixed in with regular rock and roll beats in a way that was quite unusual. And they still made it rock. I mean, it still sounded like rock and roll. So it's among their many achievements.
I love the story you shared, because if you had access to the Beatles, then not everybody had. And so you heard the song Help before it was ever released as a single, and you got to share that a little bit when you were out on the Dick Clark Caravan.
I did, yes. It's not something I'm immensely proud of, but I had learned a little bit of the song because Paul had played it to me a few times. I mean, it's a John song, but obviously, you know, in the course of recording it, obviously Paul learned it completely, and I'd learned a bit of it. And I do confess that just it was somewhere between sort of showing off and name dropping that when we were out on tour on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars with, you know, Brian Hyland and the Shirelles and the Drifters and all kinds of people, I did say, you know, oh, listen to this, isn't this cool? This is going to be the Beatles' next single, and would show off by playing a little bit of it. And I'm not sure whether they believed me or not. I like to think that when Help came out a little while later, they kind of went, oh, he wasn't making it up after all. Because I'd only learned a piece of it, you know, but enough to kind of just the opening part in the verse, which I think was so great. And of course now you that would be dangerous. You couldn't do that because somebody would have filmed it on their phone.
Right,
you'd be in all kinds of trouble.
We're talking with Peter Asher. His new book is The Beatles from A to Z, and under the letter F, one of my very favorite Beatles songs with a beautiful French horn that's part of it. Can you talk a little bit about For No One?
Yeah, I mean, the French horn solo is just brilliant and very original. I mean, you don't hear many French horns on pop records. They hear them a lot in classical music and movie scores and stuff. You know, and they have this beautiful, subtle tone. They were originally derived from a hunting horn. You know, it was just the thing you'd play to, you know, to get the pack together. But I think it was Paul's idea to use the French horn. And Paul had learned a lot about classical music very quickly, you know. He probably learned about all the other brass instruments, but from dance bands and stuff like the one his father had. But French horn's primarily a classical instrument, so he might have become aware of that through my mother, and who was a professional classical musician. I don't know. But he suggested the French horn, and George Martin took that and ran with it, you know, and between them they composed that beautiful solo. And George Martin got the best French horn player in the land to play the horn. And I remember at the time in London, the studio gossip was all about, you know, at that time, regular scale for doing a session in the studio, a three-hour session, was £9. And the horn player on For No One asked for and got a recital fee of £50. And everyone went, oh my God, what nerve and how amazing, you know, which he totally deserved. And of course, in retrospect, £50 for that solo is the bargain of the century.
Speaking of George Martin, a wonderful connection that I learned about in the book between George Martin and your mother.
Yeah, isn't that odd? It's one of the strange things that, you know, you couldn't make up, which is, it is true that, you know, George Martin had studied the oboe at the Guildhall School of Music, where he learned it. And my mother was actually a professor at the Royal Academy of Music, a different college. But he had wanted to take some private lessons, and someone obviously had recommended my mother as one of the good oboe teachers, which she certainly was. And so he had taken quite a number of private lessons from my mother long before they met later on in a Beatle context, you know. It's an extraordinary coincidence. So the first member of our family to meet, you know, to have any Beatle connection whatsoever was her and George Martin. Though, of course, at the time, George Martin wasn't yet working with the Beatles.
You also played a role somewhat in John and Yoko coming together after you started the bookshop. That's a wonderful story.
That's right. Yeah, we started a bookshop, and then after that got going, we started the art gallery. And my friend John Dunbar, who was running the art gallery, had heard about Yoko Ono and invited her to come do an exhibition in London at our gallery. And, she accepted, and they set a date, and we took ads and made the deal and all that stuff. And what you do often is before you have the actual opening, at which you invite the press and everything, once it's all set up in the gallery, you do a kind of pre-opening evening and invite friends over to have a look at the exhibition. And that's what we did, and we invited all our various friends over, which at that point in time included the Beatles. So I think we invited all of them, but it was John who came, and that's when he met Yoko for the first time.
One of the big surprises in the book for me was to learn that one of the most iconic Beatles songs could have been a hit first for Tom Jones.
Yeah, now which one was that? I remember discovering that and being fascinated by it myself and putting it in the book. Which song was it?
Long and Winding Road.
Long and Winding Road, that's right. I knew it was some really important song. Apparently, and this has been backed up by a couple of people, there was, you know, Paul was thinking about how well Tom Jones would sing it, which he undoubtedly would or would have. And at one point it suggested that maybe Tom could record it before it came out on a Beatles album, and he might be the person to have the hit with it. But somehow it didn't happen. Tom Jones had already just finished an album or something, and they weren't ready to put anything else out for a while, or for some record company technical reasons, it never happened. But actually, you know, Tom Jones could have done a great version of that song, without doubt. Paul often did that. I mean, he'd write a song and think, oh, this would be great for so-and-so, you know, whether or not they actually did it. But I think he perhaps was helped by imagining some of his favorite singers, you know, imagining Ray Charles or Peggy Lee or whoever it was, sing whatever song he was working on would give him a new perspective on it.
You got to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, and we played Nobody I Know that you performed on the Sullivan Show, but you explain in the book that Bobby Rydell kept you from performing your first big hit, A World Without Love.
It's true, he did. It's true. Not intentionally, of course. But what had happened was somebody had sent Bobby's manager a copy of World Without Love as soon as it came out in England, which was about a month before it came out in America. And the manager suggested it to Bobby as a song he might want to cover, which he did. And he made a record of it and came out the same time as ours. And, of course, Bobby Rydell was already a big star. So we were quite flattered that he'd done it, but also worried, of course, that it would prevent us getting a hit. And in the long run, we did get the hit. Our record took off. You know, we both were in the charts with Bullets at one point, but ours took off and went to number one. And it seemed to have had no ill effect at all until first time we got to New York after World Without Love was number one. Our agent, you know, was trying to get us on the Ed Sullivan Show, which normally would have been no problem because they liked the new English bands with number one records. But the Sullivan people apparently said, oh, no, you know, we can't have them on because Bobby Wright did that song on the Sullivan Show 2 weeks ago. We can't do the same song again. So, but it didn't seem to matter. So, and I know Bobby since then, of course, and there was no malice involved at all. But, and his version was kind of cool, but different. But, in the end, we had the hit, so all is well.
You've met so many people in the music business through the years, but your meeting with Janis Joplin was perhaps less than memorable.
Well, it was memorable in an odd way, yes, because I had made it to Woodstock. We'd somehow managed to get onto one of the helicopters, which was the only way to get to the actual gig. And we'd not only that, but we'd succeeded in getting a hotel room for the night because you couldn't move. You know, the traffic was seized up and the people had abandoned their cars and all that stuff. And I finally got a key to a hotel room somehow. I don't remember how. And we were making our way down the corridor, which was kind of crowded, to the hotel room. And I stepped over a woman sleeping across the corridor and with a bottle of Jack Daniels in her hand. And looked down and went, oh, it's Janis Joplin, look at that. And then we went in our room and went to bed. So it's not exactly a meeting, but nonetheless, it was sort of memorable.
Peter, you mentioned in the book that the Beatles had four great singers. And I think that's a great point that you make because people who weren't around at the time don't understand in some ways that those Ringo songs on albums were a real highlight for so many people.
Yes. I mean, the thing about the Beatles is that there was just a perfect storm, you know, that those four people with those four varied kind of talents and personalities came together at the right time and just created some of the best music ever. And yes, Ringo was immensely popular, and I think Ringo was the first solo Beatle to have a huge hit as well. I mean, Ringo's had a string of hits, you know, it's extraordinary. And you go back and listen to some of those great Ringo records, they're just terrific. And his new album, which is just out, which he produced himself, is really good.
Absolutely. He's coming here to Bangor. We're looking forward to him bringing the All-Star band here.
That was always great. I love that tour, you know, with his All-Star band. It's just killer.
Well, the book is absolutely delightful. I read it in one sitting because it's like being there listening to stories from an incredibly knowledgeable and talented Beatles fan and insider in many ways. But the appreciation that you have of their music and of what it spawned in rock and roll is just a delight to read. The book is great. And, Peter, it's wonderful for us to have the chance to talk with you again.
Thank you very much. Those were great questions, and you obviously really read the book, and I appreciate that, and it's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
That's Peter Asher here on The Best of Downtown. His new book is The Beatles from A to Z, and that will wrap it up for The Best of Downtown on this Sunday morning. Our thanks to Peter Asher, the great Cindy Williams as well. Thanks to you for joining us tomorrow on the program. We're back and live and doing our thing. Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, movie reviews from Alan Adams of the Main Edge. We'll talk a little theater with our friend Amy Giroux from 10 Bucks Theater Company as they get set to stage a holiday classic around these parts. That's all tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock right here on Z62. Hey, let's head on out the door with a little taste of a Peter Asher production. One of the biggest hits ever for Linda Ronstadt, produced by Peter Asher. Here's her version of You're No Good.
Feeling better now that we're through. Feeling better 'cause I'm over you. I learned my lesson and left a scar. Now I see how you really are. You're no good, you're no good, you're no good. Baby, you're no good.
Baby, you're no good.